This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, not a hoax, not an imaginary story, not an Elseworlds, not a what if. This is Todd Weber, and this is the return of Conversation Comics. How are you? Conversation Comics is a show where we talk about comics, but we don't just talk about comic book worlds and comic book creators. No, we go through and we treat the comic book as though you're blind and you need our help to read it. We read it page to page, panel to panel, giving you background, detail, discussing the art, discussing the plot, discussing the ephemera and the apocrypha and all that goes around the comics. And right now we're working on one of my favorite runs of books. It's The Uncanny X-Men by John Byrne and Chris Claremont. Well, we're up to issue 135. And to talk about this issue, I brought in, of course, Tim Capel, because this is one of his favorite things, too. We're going to finish this run, whether it kills us or not. So let's bring in Tim. Tim Capel, how are you today?
Todd Weber, I am pretty excellent, and it's been a minute since last we spoke, but I think that's okay, and I'm here to have fun, and I'm really glad to see you getting back to, like, doing your own podcast, man.
Yes.
I think it's been missing.
Thank you. Well, you know, we all have our own shows and our own things, but typically past, I don't know, several years I've been inundated with helping other people with their podcasts, and that's taken up the free time I would usually have to record. I'm not trying to throw any guilt on anybody, but
right.
Certain individuals have stepped up and started helping me with that. So I have a little bit of time to concentrate on my own shows, including the recently launched Binge Please. Did you listen to Binge Please, Tim?
I sure did, Todd, and I was going to bring it up. I was going to bring it up if you didn't, because on your recommendation on Binge Please, this is, I guess, a slight spoiler for the show, but I would encourage everyone to go out and listen to it. A lot of great stuff on that debut podcast. But you had talked about the program on Hulu, Pen 15, which I watched, again, on your recommendation about apparently 5 or 6 episodes of last night.
Wow.
So really in the spirit of your new show, Binge Please, I just went for it, and I'm really enjoying it. Dustin is a bitch.
Yeah. You were very, that's great. You actually binged. So you watched back to back. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, what we can do now, especially with these shorter shows, you know, a half hour show, you can go boom, boom, boom. So I don't think there are any comic book connections to that series. What do you think?
You know, I thought of one. I thought of a very tenuous connection. So Pen 15, it looks like the word penis,
yes,
right?
Huh. It does.
The, you know, middle school setting.
That's a thing that people did. You know, you want to be in the Pen 15 club, and they would write the word Pen 15 on 15. People's hands. And ha ha ha, because it's, you know, penis.
Yeah, you could spell out boobies on your calculator, you know, all this stuff. So Pen 15, penis. Do you remember in the somewhat new classic Avengers versus X-Men crossover from, been a few years now, 2012, I think it was? The Phoenix Five from that story, they were collectively within the X-Men fan community and on X-Men Twitter referred to as penis. And they were referred to as penis because if you took the first letter of each of the characters' first names, it spelled out penis.
Wow.
So there you go. Phoenix Five, yeah, it was Colossus. So you got Peter. You've got Emma Frost, E. N. Who was the N? Namor. Yeah, Namor. I was Ileana. And then S, Scott. Scott Summers. So,
wow.
Yeah. Phoenix 5, penis. We'll be talking some Phoenix on this episode. So there's how you bring it back.
I'm thinking Jonathan Hick, was that Hickman?
I mean, I think he wrote some stuff maybe around the periphery, okay. But the main story, oh God, was it Bendis maybe?
I'll have to check it out because that's on my blind spots. There was a time where I was so frustrated with the multiple books that I was just ignoring them all.
You know, yeah.
Uncanny Avengers and all that. It was a bit much for me. So
yeah. I will say I don't love it. I really don't love that story. As a matter of fact, was it Rick Remender actually?
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Because he was writing. He did Uncanny Avengers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I get those that generation. The Fractions, Remenders, Fractions. Hickmans, all kind of jumbled together, even though they're all very different in the way they write. So, but nevertheless, we are trudging on, and this is Conversation Comics. This is a show where it's a little different than other review shows you may have heard here on Place to Be Nation Pop. We go and read the comic, if not for you, with you, panel by panel, page to page, two-page spread to two-page spread, dialogue, editor's notes, everything. And then we talk about it. And sometimes these episodes can go quite a while.
Yes.
You know, you could sit down and read the comic in 10, 15 minutes, or you could listen to our episode, which is 1 to 2 hours. So what's giving you a better value? And you don't even have to pay for this. This is a totally free podcast.
That's right. Is there a Patreon or anything, though? Maybe.
No, maybe I find that kind of a beggary thing. I don't like to beg.
Yeah.
But there are expenses. And if you've set up a Patreon and, you know, you reward your members with topless pics of yourself, God bless you, Chad Campbell.
Wow. All right. HMH.
But yeah, we're not, at least I haven't embraced that. I'm looking more towards the advertising model of podcasts. And last time I investigated that, they said, oh, nobody listens. You don't have that many listeners. We're rapidly approaching the north side of, or I'm sorry, not the, we're getting close to 100,000 total downloads on Pop, which is pretty good. So we'll see, maybe revisit that topic and talk to somebody about maybe getting some advertising here. But, you know, if you want to mention Blue Chew or the usual suspects, Casper Mattresses, we can, even though those they're not mates, kicking down a dime to us.
Well, I'd like to think of it as a practice trial run. You know, they could hear that, see what good pitchmen we are.
Right. Okay, so we'll be throwing in random ads based on what we read here. You never know what segue we will have from this 40-plus-year-old comic book. Well, this is about 40 years old. We're not quite there yet. 39-year-old comic book that we're talking about today. 39 years. That's a long time, Hogan.
It's a long time. Yeah, this first issue we're going to be looking at from July, cover date of July 1980, which, God, I mean, these issues were old the first time I read them, and I myself was not old. It's just hard to believe that this material is like so easy to come back to.
Yeah, you know, 40 years, say, between 1940 and 1980, that seems like a lot. But 40 years between 1980 and 2020 doesn't seem like a lot.
Right, right. Yeah, when you put it in those terms, it's sort of mind-blowing.
So where had we left off? We had left off where Jean had tapped into, Jean Grey, of course, had tapped into the power of the Phoenix to get them out of the Hellfire Club, get the X-Men being Cyclops, Storm, Nightcrawler, Wolverine, and Colossus, who were being held by the Hellfire Club, and Jean was being presented as their Black Queen, and she finally had this eruption of power that kind of took them out of it. What exactly happened at the end there?
Yeah, so they did escape from the clutches of the Hellfire Club, fought from behind, really spectacular, all fight scene pretty much that issue we left off on, 134. So I would say that closed out what I would consider the second act of the Dark Phoenix saga, I should call it. We're going to be entering the third and final act of this saga now. And what has happened here is the turning point there is that Jean essentially ignited on the Blackbird as they're headed back to base. The power within her has been unleashed and unseated by the manipulations of Jason Wingard. Good old mastermind, yeah. So that ruse was revealed. This was in a play for power, for clout, within the inner circle of the Hellfire Club. And through these manipulations, the full power of the Phoenix, of Jean Grey, is now unleashed. And shit is about to go down. Mastermind, of course, we should mention, was all the worse for this encounter. Jean sent him on a kind of psychic, cosmic, acid trip mindbender that he will never quite fully come back from. But for all intents and purposes, he is now off the board. The Inner Circle members, the Hellfire Club, they are off the board, and we are moving fully into Dark Phoenix territory now.
So Dark Phoenix visually resembles the original Phoenix, which is Jean in a green and yellow bodysuit, but with her eyes kind of have a blacked out look, and her costume is red now. Otherwise, it's the same look, but she's calling herself Phoenix here, or at least at the end of 134. But the trailer or the next issue says Dark Phoenix. So, you know, I think even though she's not calling herself Dark Phoenix, we clearly see that she is. And look at the cover of 135. Now, having read some things in Marvel Age, what does this cover remind you of? What artist does this evoke? Jean Grey flexing and crushing the Uncanny X-Men logo between her uprised arms, her hands above her head.
Yes, this is very evocative of, I couldn't give you the issue number, but from the Silver Age landmark issue of Uncanny X-Men with the living monolith on the cover in this very same pose, basically crushing the X-Men logo, which was something you really didn't see in 1960 superhero comics. And that was by Neil Adams, I believe.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was going for. This is definitely cover that makes me think of Neil Adams, but it does have the crazy John Byrne face. And nobody draws women's faces like John Byrne.
Oh, yeah.
It's always
so very expressive. We're going to see a lot of... Byrne gets flack for not varying his faces enough, like kind of his character's all... He has a male face and a female face, but the expressions and the range of emotions he puts them through is really quite impressive and is going to be on full display as we go through the remainder of this run.
And I should mention, this run that we are focusing on has been, and we will finish it up when we finish it up, is the run of Chris Claremont and John Byrne, the writer, co-plotters, and penciler of the issue, and Terry Austin, usually the inker, almost always has been the inker for this run, so you can almost consider him part of the team. But the letterer is just as important. X-Men lettering had its own feel, and you could always tell an X-Men or New Mutants issue because the particular lettering of Tom or Zukowski. I hope I said that right. And always has been my favorite letterer. So we get this splash page of the Blackbird, the Lockheed airship, stealth technology ship I've always kind of been a fan of, but it looks like it's been pretty mangled by the psychic energy of Dark Phoenix, and really good splash page, single panel of the Blackbird above the New York skyline in Central Park, of course. we get the tagline, "Witness the Birth of a God." And, of course, this issue is entitled Dark Phoenix, issue 135.
Yeah, wow. That's an arresting visual there. The ship just basically exploding over the Manhattan skyline. I think we're in for a treat here. And, of course, you get Claremont's narrative captions as well. Mm-hmm. He's going to lay on that purple prose as he does to great effect.
Yeah.
And
we get,
it's...
Go ahead.
It's just something that... I mean, it's very dated, and we've remarked on this before, but I don't know that it would work in any other series or in any other, you know, comic that particular style, even at this time. It was just so Claremontian.
Yes. Yeah.
And when it's imitated, it's always done badly. You know, it's just only he can get away with it, I feel like.
His particular one of those voice, you know, with the simple sentence, "Her name is Jean Grey," gives her a bio, lists her powers, and then after that, he sets it up. None of that has changed, and yet everything has changed. And it's absolutely Claremont style. It's emblematic of how he writes, how he's always written, instantly recognizable. And I love it, but you're right. Nobody else can do it, and when they do, it doesn't go well. I guess I can think of that in, say, Infinity Gauntlet a little bit. You know, that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those splash pages would have it. And just it works there too, but Claremont, because of his attention to characterization, which is his strongest thing, we fall in love with these characters and the plot, but the characters are so developed at this point, it really means something when he says, this character has come from this point, and now it's been turned on its head. And again, this is the kind of thing in 1980, had I been reading this comic for 4 years or however long it's been since the Claremont and Cockrum stories of Giant Size X-Men through Uncanny X-Men 94 and beyond, this is a great payoff. You know, we're seeing some real consequences, real stakes here for the characters. This team is a family, and Jean is the big sister, and big sister is a satanic witch, basically. An all-powerful satanic witch.
Yes, yes. And now she even has her own font, as you mentioned, the great Tom Orzechowski lettering there. That's always a sign that big things are afoot when a character gets their own stylized font and word balloons.
So she pretty much blows up the airship, blows up their plane, and they're falling from the sky.
Yeah, this is it's a sequence that you know. We've got, let's see, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 panels that it can only, in real time, it's going to be playing out in seconds, right?
Right.
But you really have to give it some breathing room here on the page and, you know, pay lip service to a lot of the tactical maneuvers here. We see how the characters work together as a team to save not only themselves, but each other. I mean, you've got Storm who can fly, Nightcrawler who can teleport, but Colossus is invulnerable. You figure he's going to be okay, but you've got Cyclops and Wolverine to look out for.
Right.
They're going to go splat unless somebody thinks very quickly.
At this point, we didn't really know that Wolverine could be regenerated from, like, just if he was... we didn't think he could be... saved, you know, we thought he was vulnerable.
Yeah, he has limits, at least.
Or at least
we don't quite know what those limits are, but it, you know, suffice to say, he's not regenerating from a drop of blood at this point.
I like the classic, at least the characters that are speaking. In Colossus, we get a by the White Wolf right away.
Yes.
And then Nightcrawler in German, you know, not another. Here we go again. another Blackbird. Oh no, we have to go to Blackbird's R Us and get another one.
It's always Nightcrawler to complain about it too.
I can't do it with a German accent. I don't have my skills are limited to bad French accents. I believe. So,
and Russian. I think you can do Russian too.
I can do a little bit of Russian. So Yeah, Colossus falls to the ground with a C'Thun.
Mm-hmm.
When he lands, Nightcrawler teleports himself at least to the level, but he still crashes in the park.
Yeah, well, notably, Nightcrawler carries his momentum, his velocity. I don't know if in terms of physics I'm using the right language, but when he's falling, he can't just simply teleport to the ground. Whatever speed he's picked up is going to come with him.
So could he program himself to land upside down and like falling up when he gets down there?
That's sort of what I've wondered. I've wondered about that one, and I guess if you want to no prize it away, you could say that while theoretically he could do it, it takes a lot out of him. Maybe the strain is too much. Who knows? So
yeah.
Anyway, he has to get a little innovative.
They should have tried that in the Danger Room. You know what?
Yeah.
Let's be proactive here and get ready for any circumstance. And of course, Nightcrawler teleported. So Claremont mentions there's a stench of brimstone. Because you can't have Nightcrawler teleporting in a Claremont book without that mentioning of how bad it smells.
We must always be reminded of how it smells like farts when he teleports.
Methane. Yeah. Mm. Is that what brimstone is?
It's more like kind of like a rotten egg sort of smell, as I understand it. Kind of a sulfury.
Okay.
Think about, like, you know, natural gas, like when there's a leak or something. I remember the public utility companies around here would do these little PSAs on the radio, and it's just burned into my mind how often they ran these things.
And natural gas
smells bad for a reason.
Well, and literally it does. They've had to add that smell so you can detect it.
Yeah. Yep. So I gather that's kind of what the smell is like.
So we get to the next page, Storm, or not even the next page, sorry, the next panel. Again, the magic of our Marvel Unlimited, we get to read panel by panel, so it looks like it's the next page, but it's really just the next panel. Storm, minus her headdress, soars on the winds and creates a little, I didn't notice it was raining before, but it is raining here in New York, and she sails and catches Wolverine by the seat of his pants. Gives him a wedgie here. And she notices that we can't find Cyclops yet. So everybody's is safe and there's Cyclops, but Phoenix is going after him. Why is that?
Yeah. And Storm is theorizing here in her head. Is Phoenix going after him to save him, or could it be something worse? And she has to think very quickly here. So we get to see some kind of early tactical know-how from Storm, making that judgment call to intervene here and not take that risk of Jean Phoenix doing something far worse to Cyclops than letting him go splat. But who's to say how that one would have ended? But kudos to Storm there for taking charge.
Yeah, she fights back a little bit against Phoenix here. So it's at least enough to distract her, even though.
Yeah, and she's having some conflict over that. You know, do I really go for it here? No, I don't want to hurt my friend. But man, the mind kind of conjures what that fight would look like again over this Manhattan skyline. Holy shit! If those two went at it.
Yeah, so we basically have Jean Grey, Dark Phoenix, against the core five X-Men at this point. And team is regrouping, finding out what's going on, or at least what Gott and Himmel, Mein Gott, all this is good. there's terrible, terrible consequences here. To one of our own is nuking us. In fact, it's Scott Summers' lover, and this is a terrible situation, as Nightcrawler would say, oi flipping vey.
Yes, maybe, well said.
Oi flipping vey. I'm trying to imagine him saying the real F word in German, and that would be great too. But yeah, everybody's accounted for, but Phoenix confronts them. She swoops down upon them like the Angel of Death, and Yeah, the shit's about to hit the fan here.
God, yeah, and they are pleading with her. The dialogue and the narrative captions are, in a word, I think could be described as very extra.
For pity's sake, Gene. For pity's sake.
For pity's sake. And now, we need to get a good Mister from Cyclops. That's a Greg Phillips favorite when he calls people Mister. I guess it's like Vince McMahon calling people pal.
I'm I'm imagining Vince McMahon speaking as Cyclops.
Oh, geez.
Serious, both serious and angry.
Yeah. See, that I always hear the voices as the voice actors from the animated series. That really has stuck with me. Mm-hmm. Is that the case for you? Because I know you didn't, like, you probably weren't as religious in watching that show as I was growing up.
Well, a little bit of peek behind the curtain. I was far too cool for the X-Men animated series in college. I was reading things like Sandman and Preacher and Vertigo comics. That was the extent of what I would do comic wise in that era. But so I don't have that reference. I kind of have a combination. I don't even have the cinematic versions of these characters in my head. Not that there are a ton of them. I suppose Alan Cumming's Nightcrawler is probably the closest, you know, that one great movie where he played Nightcrawler. Well, the rest, I kind of just have had these characters in my head for longer than that, you know? So
yeah, that's sort of what I wondered is you would have been reading the comics
10 years or so before the cartoon came and 20 years before the movie came. Out of curiosity, when did you start reading X-Men? After the cartoon?
No, it was slightly before. I would say I was a regular, pretty much with the launch of the objectiveless X-Men 1 in 91. But I was, you know, a little kid, really. I mean, I would have been not even, I guess, about 8, 9 years old when that started. When did that launch? July, August? I want to say.
Yeah, it's summertime in 91.
91, yeah. So,
how many copies did you buy of that comic? Because it was a collector's item, you understand.
Well, the thing is, I would kind of end up with comics, you know, as you do when you're a kid, and you get things as gifts and, you know, birthdays and Christmas, stuff like that. So, I mean, all told, I think I ended up, you would also borrow other people's copies and occasionally give them back. So all told, I think I ended up with like just 3 copies of it. One was absolutely destroyed by my dad's German Shepherd, which he was really upset about more than me. But I was like, no, really, it's okay because number one, I've got another copy of this. Number two, it's very easily replaceable. Like even I knew that because you would walk into a comic store and just see. It would be on the stands. I mean, a million copies for years and years.
Did you have a favorite one of the covers?
I like the Cyclops and Wolverine cover.
Yeah, big figures of them in the foreground. I think I like the gatefold, you know, when you open it up and it was the poster. That was still my favorite of them. But
yeah, I mean, that's the best one. But as far as just the individual like character covers, I would go with it's Cyclops, Wolverine, and Iceman, technically. He is in the background.
Yeah, as he often is.
Yes.
So we'll get back to 135 here. The teams regroup, but Gene confronts them and then blasts them. There's a great, great Cyclops, and I'm reading Cyclops as Vince McMahon. Gene's enjoying this! using her power is turning her on. I can't do it.
What have you done?
I don't know. Acting like the ultimate physical / emotional stimulant. Because everybody thinks like that. That's what I think when somebody is blasting. I think she's turned on and this power is the ultimate physical / emotional stimulant. I boy, it probably was fine with me when I was reading this the first time, but that's bugging me at this point that he is being able, and it's just the Claremont style, that he is thinking this paragraph in the time it takes.
He's thinking in paragraphs, yes. I guess I will say that...
He's thinking in metaphors, damn it.
He's thinking in metaphors, he's thinking in paragraphs, but the substance of this is not wrong, only in the sense that he would be one to know. They do, we should point out, share a psychic rapport. So he is in her head along with her while she's doing all this stuff. He is not, so it's just kind of got to be a kick for him while she's essentially getting off on this unrestrained use of her powers at their full potential.
She goes after Colossus next, and he's uprooted a tree to try to use a tree against this goddess because, you know, we don't want to hurt the goddess, but maybe a tree will stop her or stun her for a bit. And she totally depowers him.
Yeah. He is physically forced to transform back into his human form, which, I mean, we've never seen this happen before, while he is holding this gigantic tree, so he's about to be crushed to death, essentially.
Yes, yes. His human form, while strong, is not strong enough to hold up an oak tree, or a willow tree.
No.
It doesn't say what kind of tree it is. But where did those blue pants come from? I know we've had this conversation before.
Yes.
You knew I was going to mention it. The blue pants pop up because, God forbid, a male character have bare legs.
Oh, man.
If they're not techno-organic steel.
That would just be unsightly.
You'd look like Aqualad or Robin.
This unstable molecules is always the answer.
Always. That are kept in a pocket dimension that activate when he returns to human form. Of course. Because Marvel.
And Wolverine just always there. Maybe they become translucent when he transforms into organic flesh, and you just can't see them. They're just totally invisible, see-through.
Yes.
Except when he's in flesh and blood form.
Hi, Reed. This is Charles Xavier. I need you to design me pants that can't be seen when my student turns into a metal, walking metal being. But when he is normal, please let them be just the right shade of blue that they match Wolverine's gloves and boots. Got it? Okay. I can't do a Charles Xavier accent. I do hear Xavier as Picard, believe it or not. So,
yeah.
Or Patrick Stewart.
Well,
even though the animated
is
very different.
Right. They are quite different, but... Power. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it until the opportunity really presents itself.
Okay. Yeah, he's not even on panel at this point.
No. But that Patrick Stewart portrayal, I mean, it's so iconic that how can you... It's hard not to hear that voice.
Wolverine rushes in to save the day and maybe cut down the tree and chop it, or at least help push Peter out of the way because he knows he can take the impact with his adamantium skeleton. But Jean shows that she can transmute matter into solid gold. Not just matter, but organic matter. So unlike, say, Firestorm, who can only work on inorganic things, and there's a Firestorm shout-out, the hottest character in DC Comics these days. Literally. Actually, he is being talked about. He's in Doomsday Clock right now, so... And Geoff Johns does like Firestorm, but a lot of us match heads, a lot of us fans of Firestorm are fairly upset.
Match heads, wow.
Match heads, yep. I am a big fan of Aquaman and Firestorm. Those are my top two DC heroes. You may not have known that. So
I kind of knew it, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. You knew Aquaman. Anyway, so she's showing kind of a similar moveset to Firestorm and perhaps Element Lad of the Legion of Superheroes, another deep cut. But she changes this tree into solid gold, and it pins down Wolverine and Colossus into a Canadian Russian sandwich in gold.
Right. I mean, and these are powers we've never seen her wield before.
No.
And she's doing so effortlessly here.
No, even as the Phoenix was kind of a supercharged version of Marvel Girl herself. Just telekinesis, basically, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just kind of supercharged telekinesis, telepathy, and kind of within the ballpark of what you would expect from her, just at an exponential level. Now it's just, I mean, she's essentially a god.
And we've been tracking her powers. We have been, yes, if we're taking the long view here, over the last 5 years or so, issue to issue, you know, she seems to get more powerful, notices the changes within herself. This is just on another level, and she's doing it with impunity. Dark Phoenix has no friends.
So right.
She doesn't.
Says a lot with very little.
Yeah. She's just attacking, and Storm's going to take the gloves off. She doesn't wear gloves literally, of course, but she's using her electricity and blasting her, and Phoenix doesn't really feel it at all. Dark Phoenix isn't affected, impacted like this. Although Aurora reflects that this is like when Jean, and I believe entered the McCran crystal. Here you go. You're going to have to bail me out here. Back in 108, X-Men 108.
Yep. And that was John Byrne's first issue.
Okay. And we did talk about it, but boy, it feels...
I think we did.
I think that's...
about 5 years ago.
Literally 5 years ago. So we're going to have to... More time has passed. More time has passed since we recorded that podcast than there actually was from that issue of X-Men to this issue of X-Men. So
it's quite possible.
It is possible. Storm gets her ass kicked by Phoenix right away, Dark Phoenix. We see everything's on a different level. But boy, goodness, even in close-up, these panels are fantastically drawn.
Yeah, and something else that strikes me here is, I mean, not only the artwork and the action, but in Storm's thought balloons here, she's thinking that before, when Jean was saving the universe in the heart of the Imkron crystal, which Storm was one of the few characters on hand to witness that, she's mentioning that at that time her power was tempered by joy and love, and here she senses no love, only a great sadness, pain, awful, all-consuming lust. So here she is contrasting love and lust, which I think that's a theme we can kind of continue to monitor throughout this, again, third and final act of the Dark Phoenix saga. There's going to be a lot to say on these points.
And let's talk about the Phoenix itself. We, at this point, just know of the Phoenix Force as just being this entity that saved Jean Grey when she was sacrificing herself. Phoenix Force had never appeared in comics before, so we just think of the Phoenix at this point as one and the same, just an extension of Jean, even though it's definitely this outside thing that's corrupted her. It's not anything that was in Jean before, these desires necessarily. I'm trying to balance this with the retcons that happened later.
I know. It's hard not to read this under the weight of all those subsequent retcons, which, I mean, they sort of retconned and re-retconned, and you sort of wonder where the canon is.
Yes.
With regards to a lot of this today, just because the Phoenix concept has become so very convoluted, and it's just sort of whatever they want it to be these days. But here, yeah, I mean, it's, if anything, a very, very just abstract concept. We haven't seen it really externalized at all. I mean, nobody's talking about the Phoenix Force or, hey, Jean is possessed by this thing called the Phoenix. They don't talk about it like that in these issues at all. And that was not the intent of the creators at this time. I think we are going to see those lines start to blur as this progresses, and we can kind of talk about maybe why that was, but here, yeah, it's a little bit hard to reconcile with later information and a modern reading and understanding of what the Phoenix is or is supposed to be.
Who would you say would be the previous most powerful character compared to where Phoenix is at this point? Would be somebody like Silver Surfer, Galactus?
Yeah. I would have to say Thanos. As far as like a regularly appearing character, either Silver Surfer or Thor, I guess. Yeah. I mean, certainly you have Galactus, but he's mostly trotted out as like a special event sort of thing. But in terms of characters, we're going to be that we've been following in the Marvel Universe, you know, circa 1980. It's, you know, your Silver Surfers and your Thors, that kind of that power class, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, even Xavier is kind of dwarfed by what she can do at this point. And he's recognized this. He's recognized that her power levels are surpassing his own. It's cool thinking that they were going this way with the character and, you know, we're getting all this payoff. I just wish it could have gone on longer, but we're not there yet. So,
yeah. If legend is to be believed, this was meant to go on a bit longer. We will talk about it more in future issues, but
foreshadowing here.
We'll just say that this Dark Phoenix saga itself was only intended to be the second act in a 3-act saga that Claremont and Byrne had sort of plotted out. And it ends up, that ends up not being the case, we'll just say.
We will talk about that in depth.
I think people know where we're going with this, but just for the sake of those who may not have ever read these issues, which is a possibility, I guess.
Jean has finally defeated all 5 of the X-Men. They're all unconscious here, although she could have killed them. She did not kill them. She struck them down. She cuts herself free of the ties binding to her person that she was, Jean Grey, the life she led, member of the X-Men. She's now transcended that. But for just a moment, the real Jean comes in. We don't see it, but it's described in the word balloons or in the narration that Jean Grey's face shatters with a grief that transcends thought. She sat for just a moment. But then very quickly, in another classic panel by Byrne, says that I'm done with the X-Men. I'm going to the stars. I'm going to get real power. I'm going to go take a victory lap of the universe, the galaxy. And, she reaches for the sky, summoning the lightning, laughing as the awesome bolts of energy caress her body like a lover. There it is again. More sex.
Yeah, more sex. Gotta lay on that sex when you're reading a Chris Claremont comic. But, yeah. I mean, this more so than most. I mean, the sexual themes are prevalent throughout this story.
They were in, say, the early stages of this. The allusions to her past with the Hellfire Club. And, you know, her deepest, darkest desires, even though she's being manipulated by Mr. Mastermind, by Jason Wingard, that she was, there was a, I want to say, a soap opera, daytime television, housewife, Harlequin romance, sexy thing going on, undertone here. This is pretty adult stuff, even if, you know, we did have the sex scene between Jean and Scott in Arizona. Even if we don't have a lot of explicit sexual talk, this is definitely grown-up stuff. So 8-year-old Tim Capel was getting his views on life and love and sexuality. Mr. Claremont was helping you out here.
Yes.
It's a gift for later Tims, I suppose. And as a teenager, I was a teenager reading this. This was hot shit, you know. I dated a lot of redheads in my life. I've been drawn to redheads, and I don't know if that's necessarily because of Jean Grey per se or other redheaded female characters. I'm trying to think of another one, but I think it's Jean Grey.
You know, to think that my views on non-existent views on sexuality as an 8-9 year old would have been shaped and molded and completely informed by Chris Claremont is, that's something.
It is something. It's just a hypothesis I'm throwing out there because these themes are there. You're reading the comic. Yeah. Is it affecting you subconsciously? I don't know.
Right. It's not something that consciously, I mean, yeah, you sort of you realize, well, this is something that maybe I'm not going to find in my little Scholastic book club books, no. Right? But you're not thinking about the kind of overt sexuality and the push and pull between love and lust and just all this very kind of pulpy sophistication, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
That Claremont would suffuse his scripts with, but I have to think, yeah, on some level, it's gonna affect you, especially when you are coming at it as essentially a blank slate.
Well, yeah, I know.
Give me a lot,
much to think about. Yeah, if you were in grad school,
oh yeah,
this would be a paper. Although I would probably do mine on the New Teen Titans and how that was more something I think affected my relationships because of. Specifically, the Donna Troy, Terry Long romance in New Teen Titans was something that I related to, I grasped on to, because it involved step families and step parenting. But I digress. We've reached the halfway point of this issue, approximately so, and we will take a break. We hope you've enjoyed this first half of Conversation Comics, listening to us talk about Uncanny X-Men 135 Dark Phoenix. Stick around. We will be right back.
All right.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back to Conversation Comics here on Place to Be Nation Pop. We hope you enjoyed that little ad break featuring our own JT Rosero and Chad Campbell telling you all about the shows on Place to Be Nation Wrestling and Place to Be Nation Pop feeds. We've had a busy week here on the Place to Be Nation Pop feed. We've got a little something for everyone. We've talked about Binge Please, my show from last week where I talked about Pen 15, talked about what Binge Please is all about. That was the first episode. I hope Tim will be on that show someday because...
Oh, I'd love to be on that show.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, you are now my third booked guest, with a future indeterminate date. Hoping to get my wife on that show, but I have a feeling it's not going to happen, so we'll see.
That would be a debut, podcast debut for her, right?
Yes, yes. And I'm just like setting the odds of that at about 200 to 1, but you never know.
Never know.
We'll see. Steve and Kelly are back with Songs with Friends, talking about November Rain and fronting. Tim, have you ever fronted?
Not deliberately, no. I also have not listened to that episode as of yet, a little bit behind, but I feel like I always learn something new from any Songs with Friends installment with Steve and Kelly. Always an entertaining and insightful listen.
Yes, because it's a different kind of a music show. You know, they are breaking down the lyrical content of these songs. You know, they'll talk about the bands and the artists themselves here and there, but they're specifically talking about the lyrics, and that takes them, much like this show, takes them on journeys that you don't necessarily expect. So, yeah, looking forward to – Steve is actually asked to be on Binge Please, too. So hopefully that will happen. I have never been frontin'. It's not my thing. We had Andy Atherton's latest great debate came in. Had Russell Sellers, David Sunday, Jason Sherman, and a newcomer named Steve Patty. They debated subjects across a spectrum of topics, sports, movies, pop culture. Andy does a lot of shows here on Place to Be Nation Pop. We're glad to have him. He's also hosting the candy tournament here on Place to Be Nation. We've got sugary 64, and then we get the sweet 16. I don't know what we're going to call the final four. We're doing rounds and breaking it down. It's kind of our tribute to March Madness and the NCAA, but with candy, because who doesn't love candy? If you don't like sweets, you've got real big issues. What's wrong with you?
Who knew there were so many candies, in fact? I mean, we have a whole tournament devoted to candy. Just, it's in my mind, I would have to say anything chocolate and peanut butter is going to be seated very high. I mean, that's I think, you know, Reese's products, for my personal favorites, should really sweep the tournament.
Yes, yes. Are there any favorite candy bars that you have that weren't seeded or we haven't talked about so far?
No, absolutely not.
So I'm a fan of peanut butter Snickers. You don't find that too often, but it's out there.
I don't know if I've had those.
Oh, it's good stuff. So instead of the caramel, they put the peanut butter in there and you eat it.
Oh, that sounds so much better.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like having chunky peanut butter plus the nougat.
I'll take that over caramel any day.
Okay, so you know what else is really good is you go to Costco and you get the big jars of Skippy peanut butter, the creamy. I prefer creamy because for diverticulitis reasons. Anyway, so
agreed.
And then you freeze either a Twix bar or a Three Musketeers bar, and then you dip it in the ice cream and eat it like that.
Oh, I got you.
I think we're going to have a new podcast here. New podcast ideas. So, yeah.
Binge eating.
And crying. So, yes.
Subjects I'm well versed
in. Okay. So, let's bring this back. NBA team podcast, Adam Riche, Adam Murray, talking about basketball. Do you have a favorite basketball team, Tim?
Yes, another subject I'm well versed in.
I myself am a Sacramento Kings fan. I think everybody knows that if you listen to my shows. But the Sacramento Kings almost moved to Richmond or Virginia Beach a few years ago. Were you aware of this?
Wow. Of course. Yes. that would have been a very exciting development. You know, you mentioned AA's The Great Debate podcast. I was on, was it the first or second episode of that? I really excelled in the sports segment, I thought.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, all the sports shows and offerings are just straight up my cul-de-sac.
Are you a fan of sports ball?
Oh, I love sports ball. Yeah.
Excellent. Yes, I know. Tim thinks sports is like rooting for laundry, right?
Yes. Rooting for paint to dry.
We are also part of Place to Be Nation Comics. There are lots of shows involving Place to Be Nation Comics featuring hosts like Russell Sellers, myself, yourself, and the Hard Traveling Fanboys. The longest running weekly comic book podcast. Damn it!
Fuck. Yep.
It's episodic that gets me in trouble every time. I've managed this team for a long time, 153 episodes in the can, and I still can't say longest weekly, longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all Place to Be Nation. There it is. I didn't even have to read it, but thank you. I forgot episodic the first time. Anyway, that's our weekly comic book show here on Place to Be Nation Pop. They talk about what they've been reading, what they've been watching, rundown of news, and then they have segments about topics that are often themed. This month, the theme is Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel, the 21st MCU Marvel Cinematic Universe film. Have you seen Captain Marvel, Tim?
I have seen Captain Marvel, and I am in the middle of listening to their, review of Captain Marvel in and around the recording of this very episode. So what a great review for what I've heard so far for what was a pretty great movie. I mean, it's not, I wouldn't put it in like my top five MCU, but it's not far short. I mean, it's sort of like the top of the middle of the pack for me. And I mean, that's kind of high praise given that there aren't really any clunkers in that series.
There are some you don't necessarily like, but yeah, not. I'm being nice here because of certain events, certain podcasts we've had where certain topics were discussed. But I would say I'm kind of with you. I'm going to put it maybe in the and I've said this for some of the last ones. I said this about, I think, Ant-Man and the Wasp, right in the middle. Right in the middle. It's the Cody line of MCU movies for me. And
well said.
I did enjoy it quite a bit. I enjoy it more because I think of our Marvel Age experience. We are, of course, co-hosts on the Marvel Age podcast, where we talk about chronological years in Marvel comics. We are in 1969. We just finished it up. So we're two of the Sarcastic Four, along with Nick Duke and Russell Sellers. And we just have been talking a little bit about Captain Marvel, who is the spiritual predecessor to Captain Marvel, Carol Danvers. We've actually talked about Carol Danvers on that show too. But yeah, having that background, that influenced my viewing of that show.
Yeah, and in fact, the name of the, trying not to get into spoilers here, but there's a character with the surname Lawson in the film Captain Marvel, which was a name I recognized from our Captain Marvel reading from Marvel Age.
Had I not read it in Marvel Age, it would have been lost on me. I would have thought, they picked that name out of their butts. But no. Mm-hmm.
Would have flown right over my head.
Yeah. That's why we're doing this. You know, we're getting the full width and breadth of the Marvel Universe. And, of course, after the Marvel Age, there is always the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast, a show hosted by Ben Morse, where he goes through and picks apart our opinions and gives his background as a longtime employee in management of Marvel. And usually some kind of understanding is reached, but often our opinions don't match. And there is an upcoming episode of that show following up on our 1969 Part 2 episode that Ben taped with a very special guest named Todd Weber. So that's going to be a good show. I hope you guys enjoy that. We talk a lot about Captain America.
Oh, so, okay. Yeah, near and dear to my heart.
Yes. How would you rank your love of Captain America versus your love of the X-Men?
Ooh, I knew. I kind of had a feeling you'd do.
FM. FM, no kill. FM, X-Men, Captain America.
Here's the thing. Cap was really my first comics love, and I think I've told this story before, so I won't, belabor the point here. So you kind of never forget your first. You're going to want to go back to your first and hold them in very high esteem, very, very high esteem. So on that level, it's Cap. But in terms of what just kind of speaks to me and sings to my soul, it's X-Men. And I know that sounds very, very corny, but like, X-Men comics were like important to me, you know what I mean? Like in a way that other comics that I just enjoyed were not. So that's why, I have to look at them a little bit differently. And when push comes to shove, I guess I'm gonna have to side with my mutants, man.
So if I'm reading this correctly, Captain America is your Lana Lang, and the X-Men are your Lois Lane.
Is Chuck Austin writing this?
He will be soon. He needs the work.
Let's go with it.
Okay.
I guess I can't say I have tremendously impassioned feelings about the Lana Lois thing.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm a big fan of, say, the Man of Steel, the original John Byrne one, because I'm a John Byrne mark, have been for a long time. And in that one, I was always, Lana all the way. You know, even though he presented an updated Lois, I don't know. I've gone back and forth. It's Betty and Veronica for me, too, you know.
Yeah.
Almost literally.
I just haven't had enough exposure to Lana, I guess, is the problem.
Well, Smallville, my friend, is all the exposure you need. Because if you're not in love with annoying Lana Lang after Smallville TV show, I don't know what your problem is. So, Tim, you are in the Marvel Age Sarcastic Four with me. What other podcasts are you a part of, both in Place to Be Nation Pop and Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feeds?
Yeah, so on Place to Be Nation Pop, my other regular gig would be Talkin' Pop with Jennifer Smith. Kind of a talk show, if you will, where, I mean, it's mostly that we don't know what it is. It's whatever it wants to be and whatever it needs to be to fit the zeitgeist. And we have special guests. We learn about their lives and their very somewhat unique, interesting experiences, such as yourself, Todd Weber. I think you were
number two. Yeah.
Yeah. Second guest.
As usual.
Learned a lot about you. Got to know you more, and very entertaining episode, I thought.
Roommate stories, lots of them, yeah.
Yeah, roommate stories. Can't go wrong there. But, I mean, we also, sometimes it's just the two of us, and we'll have like a live watch of something, which we did on our most recent outing, where we watched the great film from the romantic comedy, 1993's My Father, the Hero, with a uncomfortably young Katherine Heigl and the always just stunning patron saint of Place to Be Nation, Pop, Gérard Depardieu.
He is quite the handsome man. He is quite the actor. I'm sure he would make a great father figure to Katherine Heigl. And, yeah, I'm imagining that. Especially, like, imagining them getting it on with him and his Cyrano de Bergerac nose.
We did comment on this, yes.
I need to listen. It's on my queue.
Look for that. And he's a stud in that movie, man. Oh, man. Anyway, check it out. We've gotten zero feedback on that episode, so it seems to have been well received.
Well, you can't say we're not giving you enough content here on the Place to Be Nation Pop.
Yes. It's occasionally eclectic. On Place to Be Nation Wrestling, Jenny and I also have a show spinoff of Talkin' Pop. It is called Talkin' WCW. There we are joined by a third man in the booth. That is one half of the hard-traveling fanboys, Greg Phillips. And that show has been so much fun for all of us to do. We actually just recorded our third episode. And I'll go ahead and give you a scoop here, Todd. We're covering the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. So each installment of Talking WCW, we decide our subject and we each choose a match from that person's WCW career. And could be a very famous match, could be one under the radar that's just a personal favorite we want to talk about. And we watch it, we come together, we talk about it. So we chose three matches to represent Ric Flair in WCW. And that show will be dropping on the 22nd, I believe, of March.
Did anybody pick Starrcade 94?
Starrcade 94?
Was it Starrcade 94, the Flair Vader?
Starrcade 93 was Flair Vader.
There it is. Yeah, Hogan was there by 94. I apologize.
I would say stay tuned.
Okay. Yeah, I have a feeling.
Again, I gave you a scoop, maybe two scoops.
Yeah, two scoops, better than one. Okay, cool. So you're in a ton of shows. I'm in a couple shows. We've got other wrestling shows. We've got What If, also featuring the Hard Traveling Fanboys. So we have a lot of shows done by a select circle of podcast producers, wouldn't you say, Tim?
I sure would. I've said before, we're kind of an incestuous bunch. We sort of cannibalize each... Wow, I made us sound like some real degenerates.
Sex cult.
Yeah, yeah. Welcome to the sex cult that is Place to Be Nation.
I don't know if you'll have time to vote on the Sassies, but like Geek and Sassy on Facebook, get a ballot. Vote for your favorite sassy moments, for your favorite sassy streaming service, your favorite sassy animated series, your favorite sassy live chats, gifts.
Telling tales out of skewer.
Oh, you're right. Never mind. I shouldn't talk about the live chats, but the first rule of live chats is we don't talk about the live chats. But, yes. Anyway, we have quite the happenings here. We're thankful that you have subscribed to Place to Be Nation Pop and Place to Be Nation Wrestling on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. We're available on Spotify. There's even some YouTubes of our podcasts, and that's stimulating visual content where you look at just a blank screen, but you listen to our shows. So,
truly what YouTube was intended for.
And that's only that it's funny because there are shows that we've done that have gotten yanked from YouTube because they use copywritten music that gets flagged. So yep. Sunday Groove, I'm looking at you, but that's okay because how are you going to do a show about a subject like that without using the music in your theme? So, you know, what I have done as a podcast producer for things like Jim Ross singing karaoke on the Hard Traveling
Fanboys. You'll get it right eventually.
Yes. Is use a karaoke track. So I search YouTube and I find a sound-alike track of, say, TLC's Waterfalls. And then we get Jim Ross singing over that. And it won't get flagged because it's not the actual copywritten material. So you should check that out. Available every episode on Hard Traveling Fanboys. We need to get back into X-Men 135. That was the longest live read in the history of Place to Be Nation or Place to Be Nation Pop, and I'm quite proud of it. I'm glad you were a part of it, Tim. So
Jenny is going to beat our asses for that.
You know, that was a terrible live read.
It was a long, long-winded. This is a long-winded show, though. And I would just say that
y'all are being extra.
Yeah, we are being extra, but if anyone has any complaints about the length of this show, I mean, let's face it, we're talking comics that are very, very dense, so that provides a lot of content for us to have to cover here. And number two...
No, this is not Ultimate X-Men, where you can read it in like 3 minutes, especially, you know, the Kirkman issues.
Oh, God. Those should not be read in any minutes. I mean,
boy, we're talking about the richest man in comics, Robert Kirkman.
Well, this is true. Good Lord. But, I mean, the other thing about the length, I mean, who's going to complain about the length?
Hey-o.
But if you do, this is one of the most landmark runs in superhero comics ever. So maybe we, you know, just maybe ought to give it its due. And just, if anything warranted, the time that we've taken to cover some comics, I would say this run does.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think for a while, Marvel Age was kind of scratching the itch that I had of doing a show on comics. But this, getting back into it and rereading, like, oh yeah, this is my jam. Doing a comic show about a comic you absolutely love. And boy, this is... Especially when you consider the years that this came out in, 78 through 81. My goodness, tremendous, tremendous quality from Byrne Claremont. We return to Uncanny X-Men 135. Phoenix has just flown off to conquer the galaxy. And the cops have arrived at the Hellfire Club to check it out, to see what's going on, what the business is. Why... Is there a hole in your roof and all these things?
Yes. Well, as far as they know, this is just a kind of private club, very upper crust Manhattanites are going to frequent this place, and how is there this giant, like, what seems to be like nightclub shooting or brawl at this kind of establishment?
On the surface, to the cops anyway, the X-Men are the perps, and the Hellfire Club or the establishment are the good people, and that's the way they want to keep it, right? I mean, Sebastian Shaw here is buddying up with a new figure with his white temples. He looks very familiar. He looks like Reed Richards with glasses, but that's not Reed Richards. Who is that, Tim?
That would be one Senator Robert Kelly, who was mentioned a few issues prior, but we have not seen him yet. And this is his first on-panel appearance of a figure who is going to be quite notorious in X-Men comics lore. This is a anti-mutant legislation-pushing senator. He's going to kind of flip-flop in his ideology over the years, but is largely a thorn in the side of our protagonists for the better part of, gosh, I'd say two decades.
For a long time, and even has infiltrated the X-Men family of films here, right from the start, right from the very first one.
Yeah, he met a rather unfortunate fate in that first X-Men movie. He turned into water and sent Storm running screaming out of the room.
And that was it. They never had a return of that character, or he just kind of was diffused among the ocean, you think, or what happened?
Yeah, I think that, you can't really put the toothpaste back in the tube, and you're not really going to come back from turning into a puddle of water either. So I guess he evaporated on the mansion floor at some point.
So now he's vapor, now he's air, he's the mist. We're not talking about the movies, we're talking about the comics here, and we get the intimation that he and Sebastian Shaw are on a very close personal basis. They are friends, using first names. I don't use first names with senators, do you?
No. This is, they're clearly in cahoots. And Sebastian Shaw, we've talked before about how he's this very sort of shrewd, pragmatic, industrialist in that he will kind of play all sides to his own benefit. He's, playing fucking eight-dimensional, 12-dimensional chess with all of these major movers and shakers of the Marvel Universe, often supporting anti-mutant measures just to further his own agenda.
So he's just Roddy Piper, you're saying?
Yeah,
he's playing chess when everybody else is playing tiddlywinks.
Very good. Now we also see someone being loaded up into an ambulance here, and that is in fact Harry Leland, member of the Inner Circle, who Wolverine did a number on. So they don't have the sheet over his head, so we can infer that he is still alive. We will see him again.
Someday.
Well, not pictured here is, the Hellfire Club mansion, just a couple blocks down from Avengers Mansion. So not pictured is a gypsy woman walking by him and gently caressing his face and uttering the words, Fata.
Very good, deep cut. Of course, we're talking about the Stephen King classic Thinner, but boy, Harry Leland, if he were not his Orson Welles proportions, would not be nearly as intimidating a character. It's kind of like the Blob had he an eating disorder.
True.
So, yes. But we're getting too heavy on the in jokes, on the thinna jokes. The Robert Kelly is obviously mad at the X-Men because we assume that Shaw and the Hellfire Club are paying him quite a bit here. They're his they're supporting him. Shaw puts the suggestion that we get the Sentinels, who are they? The Sentinels out from under their mothballs to get the X-Men to collect them. Puts that thought into Kelly's head. And
yeah.
Which is important to go back and think here, because we know, having read these books, that there is a major Sentinel storyline in a few issues from now. So it's good that they Claremont's kind of putting that back in the reader's head here.
That's the one box we haven't really checked in this run is a good big Sentinel story. Which, I mean, Claremont and Cockrum had one, of course, but that was some 30-some issues ago. 40 issues ago, almost.
I think, when I think Sentinels, I think the video game. The arcade tabletop, or stand-up game. You know, I think the Sentinels, although they've been in the cartoons, they've been in different iterations in the comics. We read the Master Mold in the Sentinels and the original Stan Lee run of X-Men. Kind of classic X-Men villain. And, of course, in the movies, Sentinels are referred to, but I don't think they've been convincingly portrayed to me.
No.
You know, they're not the big, slow robots that I want to visually see. These big, I want that purple robot, you know? And I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, on the one hand, I understand it's kind of hard to do in a film, that sort of thing, convincingly. But on the other hand, it's rare that you encounter a bad Sentinel story. I mean, across different media, you look at certainly the comics themselves. They were used to great effect in the animated series in the 90s. You mentioned the video game, too. It's just, how do you go wrong with these kind of very disposable villains? So it provides you with a lot of action, but also speaks to the core themes of the series.
Well, I think, you know, in 14 years when we get to the issues, we will have a chance to investigate what Claremont was saving up the Sentinels for and kind of the ultimate – well, we won't spoil it just yet.
Yeah.
So while Kelly and Shaw are talking about, well, how do we stop the X-Men, their mutant menace – all the while, Kelly is unaware that Shaw is, of course, a mutant. Leland is a mutant. Donald Pierce is a weirdo. We have them looking up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's a bird made of fire. We have the Phoenix. We have the Phoenix effect. Giant flame bird coming down to the Hellfire Club, which must mean that Sebastian Shaw.
And this looks amazing, by the way.
It is really well drawn. It's kind of, again, iconic, perfectly drawn. You get the effect. I used to watch this show called Battle of the Planets, which was an early anime, also known as G-Force. And their ship would turn into a fiery phoenix. So this reminds me of that, this giant phoenix. But this is beautifully drawn. Almost,
it's hard to get across in what is an audio medium here. It is. But I would say if you've got that MU subscription, track this down here in issue 135 to see this fantastic panel of that Phoenix Raptor descending.
Yeah, it's negative space. The way you look at the way he's drawn it, you know, use the plaques around the bird, and then all the detail of the bird is made by shapes, not lines, but shapes. So
yes,
yeah, it's really, the more you look at it, the more you appreciate it. Phoenix makes its presence known, but we assume she's kind of collecting power and she's going to go out of the atmosphere here. We move on, and speaking of Reed Richards, there's Reed Richards and Ben Grimm getting out of the shower. I was going to say
this scene will be evoked. I mean, a lot of stuff from Dark Phoenix will be evoked in a later storyline in the 90s called Fatal Attractions. That's first thing that popped into my mind when I saw this.
There's a news alert and everybody is kind of doing what they're doing and they see the news alert. Is that what's up? Or
yeah, it's when Magneto does something very, very, not probably what you're thinking of, but before that.
Okay, before the Wolverine thing. Okay.
Yeah, what leads to the Wolverine thing, that it's just kind of seared into my brain, just growing up on those 90s X-Men comics.
Well, I'm sure we'll get to that on Marvel Age, but that's cool that we see it here. And we've seen it in earlier episodes of our show, issues of Uncanny X-Men, where, say, Beast is on monitor duty and he sees this. But we see a cross-section of the whole Marvel Universe here. Everybody is noticing. This is not happening in a vacuum. Well, it will and shall be in space, and that is a vacuum, but you know what I mean. Reed Richards notices notices the Phoenix Effect and thing is out of the shower, but he doesn't mention Aunt Petunia. What's wrong? He was getting nice and lathered up when he had to go and hit the red alert. So I have
to
think,
mention Yancey Street at least.
Thing was getting down to business in the shower.
Hmm. Okay.
I think.
Yeah.
I think.
Running through my mind how that would logistically work, but perhaps conversation for a different show.
Yeah, we want to maintain our E for everyone. Oh, wait, it's E for explicit. But regardless, we're going to... Yeah, anyway, we'll let you speculate that Jason Lee, Stan Lee talk from Mallrats. Yeah. We'll keep going. Who else sees and takes notice of the Phoenix? It's the Amazing Spider-Man. Always a treat to see John Byrne draw the Spider-Man, although I didn't like the later iterations of him drawing Spider-Man in the 90s and the Spider-Man Chapter 1. You didn't like it?
No.
It's not good, is it?
No, Chapter 1 is...
And then they gave me a regular Spider-Man book after that. Yeah, Chapter 1 is very, very forgettable. I would love to talk of that with Ben Moore someday, just like... Why did this happen? Why?
Well, that's the series where it's revealed that Norman Osborn and the Sandman are related because they both have Osborn hair.
Right, because
basketball hair.
There are no coincidences in John Byrnedom. Everything must be connected. Nope. If you have basketball hair, it can't just be Steve Ditko was trying to draw something differently. it can't be that. God forbid. So, but anyway, at this point, I still liked the way John Byrne was drawing Spider-Man. Of course, I read Marvel Team-Up back in the 70s. John Byrne used to draw that series here and there. And some of the Marvel Team-Ups drawn by Byrne, I recall an issue of Byrne drawing Spider-Man, Human Torch versus the Super Skrull. And it's kind of one of my early comics that I still think of as, okay, what was I reading at 7, 8 years old? And that would be on it. Of course, the sequel to that had an early appearance of Miss Marvel in her first costume. Short hair, long cape kind of thing. So anyways, we get rare... It's always a treat when Byrne would draw the Marvel Universe in general, at least up until, say, after Namor. I'd say Namor is like the last gasp of good Byrne. And we're talking the Namor series from 92, and then he got a little, I don't know, he just started thinking about quantity versus quality, I think, my opinion. We'll get there. We see a Greenwich Village appearance of Doctor Strange.
Right.
What's he reading? He's reading the Book of Hells.
Okay. Book of Hells.
Also known as TNA Impact 2002 through 2016. The Dave Meltzer reviews. I sense images of great mystic power. So what's happening here? Phoenix is being revealed to sensitive people, either scientifically by Reed, his spider sense, which, because all spiders have spider sense, don't you know?
And libtard cucks who are easily triggered. Oh. Speaking of sensitive people.
Guilty as charged.
Hard scene.
But yes, sensitive people. Thank you. That was a good shout out. Speaking of Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange can sense Dark Phoenix here. He doesn't even see her. He just knows.
Right.
He senses a disturbance in the Force.
You would think Doctor Strange could actually do something about this. However, I guess...
There's too much reading to be done, man.
There's too much reading to be done.
I gotta put these books back in order, damn it.
Yes, he has a very specific system. If it gets out of order, I mean, all hell is going to be unleashed, from those TNA Dave Meltzer reviews. And this is just, frankly, out of his jurisdiction, so...
I'm not even going to explore it, but I take note of it. Then we get Silver Surfer. At least according to Marvel Universe, that's the next panel. Silver Surfer senses a kindred soul.
Yeah.
So
that's a very Silver Surfer observation,
too. Yeah. Oh, I sense somebody who's got great power. She's a child of the stars, and yet not like me at all because, well, she's red. and she has fire, and she's not going to be chosen as the Herald of Galactus, but who will be? Frankie Ray, known as kind of the Human Torch, and then Nova, who had kind of the same look as Phoenix, or at least influenced by Phoenix. Which came first, do you know?
That's true. So I think Phoenix came first, right?
I think so too, because Byrne...
Because we're only 1980.
Went from this to drawing and writing Silver.
Yeah, Spider, yeah. So yeah. He's not even done with X-Men yet. So, I mean, we're only in 1980.
Maybe he got this idea by seeing the two characters, Phoenix and Silver Surfer, and maybe combining them.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Frankie Ray, but that's Fantastic Four. That's another story.
Well, I will say that John Byrne has talked about kind of revisiting this whole Silver Surfer, maybe wanting to reach out to and interact with Phoenix here. You remember his series, X-Men, The Hidden Years?
Yeah, I talked about that on the latest issue, episode of Marvel Age Masterclass with Ben Morris, which you can listen to right here on Place to Be Nation Pop.
Very good. So this series, which is John Byrne doing the Silver Age X-Men, basically just flashbacks in the 90s, is when this series was published, had that continued. It only lasted, I think, a little over 20 issues. He says that he would have done this kind of supposed Silver Surfer Phoenix story, even though it was...
Pre-Jean Grey Phoenix, I gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, Siri just woke up for some reason. Anyway, it could
hey,
have
Siri,
been
open Gray. Dinner.
It may have actually been later on after the period he was covering in X-Men The Hidden Years and this version of Phoenix. Well, so, I don't know.
In X-Men The Hidden Years, he liked to throw in Easter eggs of the modern X-Men team, or at least the post-giant size X-Men team. And, you know, you got to see a lot of Young Storm and things like that. I had that series. It was kind of a continuation, intended as a continuation of the Thomas and Adams years of X-Men. And they didn't quite get into my goal for it. My goal for that book, not that I was a creator or anything, but I would have loved for those to canonically replace, I think it was X-Men 67 through 93.
Yeah,
where the reprint issues were. They're worthless. There's no point to ever collecting Uncanny X-Men 68 through 93 because they're just reprints of earlier things. There's no original material. If there is, it's a backup origin story that's kind of a throwaway. There's, if you read on the MU app, it goes straight from that last original Roy Thomas issue to Uncanny X-Men 94, and then they list Giant Size X-Men, where this team that we're reading about is introduced elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, unless you have no way of reading the early original X-Men stories, then you're not going to find anything, as you said, of value in issues 67 through 93. They have some new covers, but, I mean, unless that's your bag, then it's just they exist as, you know, as a way to, I guess, keep the series in publication and generating some revenue.
Right, newsstands.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I can't imagine they published it if it, you know, didn't churn out at least a dollar of profit.
I mean, how often were things even canceled back then? Not too much, right? I mean, they introduced a book and then it didn't last. I mean, Hulk was canceled very quickly.
Yeah.
But that's about it that I can see that I've seen an example of. Anyway, back to this. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, X-Men was gone for, I think, about 9 or 10 months between issues 66 and 67, which is darn close to being canceled. And when your first issue back is just a reprint, and it remains in reprints for the better part of 4 or 5 years, then that's kind of your silver Bronze Age version of canceling a book.
Yeah, and things were happening. You know, they updated Beast pretty quickly. They threw together the Defenders and put some of the other X-Men in there. The X-Men were pretty much done.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's awesome that Len Wein specifically got this team back up and running and got it to where let's try something new and different with an international team of Young Mutants. And lo and behold, the world was changed because it became the top-selling book eventually. Fostered in some of the top talent in comics. You can think of not just Byrne and Claremont, but guys like Paul Smith and John Romita Jr. and Jim Lee and people like that who got to work on the property. I mean, it's you can't understate the importance of X-Men and just that one decision to revitalize it in the mid-70s with this international cast of brand new characters Claremont was allowed to introduce, stick with, develop, and it caught fire because it's great.
So, there's a fascinating, like, what if of history that where would the American comics landscape be had there been, like, a different version of X-Men in the 70s? Like, you would see weird stuff. Like, you mentioned the developments with Beast. I think Steve Englehart kind of took a shine to the original X-Men and wanted to do stuff with them, and it just never really got off the ground until, you know, the big international concepts, you know, really spearheaded by Len Wein and Roy Thomas and guys like that came to the forefront. But what if, like, there had been a revitalized new X-Men series kind of doing the same stuff with that original team, just in the 70s, you figure it didn't catch on the first time, and if they hadn't found Chris Claremont and this great the stable of artists that would contribute so much to the series, like you said, and it just doesn't really go anywhere, we're looking at a very, very different industry.
Very much so. I'm thankful that the replacement artist for Byrne was Dave Cockrum, who had at least continuity to the book, to the title, so people had been reading it, were familiar with him. But honestly, I've never been a fan of Cockrum on the X-Men. Pales in comparison to what Byrne was doing. And I feel bad because he's dead, but...
right. He was a great first choice of artist with him and Claremont, and they're just throwing everything at the walls to see what sticks. And then you got John Byrne. It's like, okay, now we're really cooking with something. Mm-hmm. But to go back to Cockrum did feel a little bit, I don't know, just like the series had evolved past those sensibilities maybe. And that's to take nothing away from Dave Cockrum. I just think he wasn't the greatest fit, you know, for a return run.
Right, we couldn't go back again. Couldn't go home again. It wasn't quite the same, but we're again getting we still have lots of John Byrne to enjoy here.
We do.
All right. So
hey, at least this aside is actually about X-Men.
Yeah. She leaves the atmosphere. Jean is going on, and she just passes an Avengers Quinjet. Oh, what's up with that? Is that the Beast? We were just talking about him. Yes, it is. The Beast is flying around in the atmosphere. He might be returning home from a mission or visiting Alison Blair, the Dazzler. Oh, they weren't connected at this point. What do you think Beast was out there doing? They even say?
He's got an Avengers emblem on this thing. So it's the Quinjet, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so I guess he's just, as you said before, perhaps on monitor duty.
Often. But at least he's an X-Men, and X-Man, former X-Men, has the tie to the team. He investigates where she blasted off from, and she finds the X-Men, or he finds the X-Men, and they're all unconscious. He wakes them. He talks about the solid gold tree, and look, the Beast can kind of lift it high enough for them to get out. Colossus and
has a hard time doing so.
He does, but you know he's got, as we were told in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, Beast has some super strength, especially in his legs. He can do a lot of leg pressing, so... He's a strong guy. Also, in the official Marvel Superheroes role-playing game from TSR, you would have these stat cards for the characters, and if they had any amount of super strength from Spider-Man or even anybody enhanced, they would even say that Captain America had a little bit of enhanced strength in those days.
That was always a little bit.
Right.
I don't know.
It depends. Depends on the writer. Depends on what they need. Is it the peak of human, or is it post-human? But again, we're not talking about Cap. We're talking about Beast. Beast is for story purposes, able to lift this golden tree. Boy, it'd be cool to find out what happened to that gold tree. What do you think?
Yeah, is this actual gold, or is this just kind of a gold-like substance? Because potentially, somebody became very rich.
Very rich.
You know, just excavating the... Hey, somebody from Damage Control rolls up on the scene here, tries to put the park back together, and realizes, this tree is made of gold. Let's put that into the budget.
Now I'm writing Golden Tree fanfic.
Golden Tree fanfic. Another great untold tale.
We'll have to see. You know, that's something we can talk to... We could talk about and see if there are any plans for the Golden Tree to make a... whatever happened to the Golden Tree? Does Marvel have plans to publish a 12-issue maxi-series about the Golden Tree Chronicles?
We need to pick Ben's brain about that.
I think so. Do you think Ben has read this run?
Oh, no doubt.
I'm sure he's... You better have... Yeah. You worked at Wizard and then Marvel. You have had to have read this run, but...
He's a comics fan above all else. He's an X-Men fan.
But nobody asks the hard questions about the Golden Tree.
No. No, they don't. So
now, if that was if that tree was a broccoli person.
Oh, God.
Oh, but I digress. We're not there yet.
We're about to be.
We're about to be there. Get ready, broccoli lovers. Beast collects the X-Men and they get on the Quinjet. They head towards the Bronx. Or they go across the Bronx, go into Westchester County, the home of the mansion, X-Mansion on Gray Malkin Lane. We segue into Arizona, where you and I were talking about Cyclops and Jean Grey getting it on in Arizona. Well,
yes, the achingly romantic scene on the butte.
Here is the Angel, Warren Worthington and Charles Xavier not getting it on, but... Yeah. Xavier felt something psychically happen, and he talks to Moira McTaggart. We haven't talked about her for a while.
Yes, he's cybering with Moira McTaggart. Right, and they're just sort of comparing notes. And these are observations that particularly I think Moira has had in the issues we've covered leading up to this about how, you know, all the scans are basically right off the chart with Phoenix and her powers, which... Recall the Proteus saga, that great yep. four-issue story where this team tackles Moira's wayward mutant son, and Phoenix kind of has a big showdown with him. And her powers are really just growing throughout that arc, as they have been throughout the entirety of this run. And Moira sums it up by saying, if you want a convenient buzzword description for her, cosmic fits the bill nicely.
Cosmic, you say?
So that's what we're dealing with here.
We are going cosmic with Phoenix. And Tim, do the X-Men have any experience with cosmic entities, interstellar travel, or alien races?
Well, yes. Going back to the original Phoenix saga, all the shenanigans with the M'Kron crystal. Lalandra's brother Deken, the Emperor of the Shi'ar Empire, trying to harness its energies. We saw Phoenix during that storyline power up a Stargate on Earth, and that's how they made that kind of interstellar jaunt. And that was the first real display of, like, whoa, she got an upgrade, you know? When seeing her accomplish that feat, which is something that, again, you're talking like Silver Surfer, Thor levels of power to pull off something like that. Yeah. So, yeah, you had that. You had...
Starjammers.
Starjammers during that storyline as well. Even before that, some of the stuff with... Remember the Xenox, the aliens?
X-Nox, yeah, I used to call them. Yeah,
X-Nox, okay. Yeah. Stay tuned to Marvel Age. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think there was any interstellar travel there, but they were an interstellar menace.
Yeah, it really feels like that stuff started with Claremont and Cockrum. And But we're revisiting it here because she's going out. She's drawing the attention of things, of forces that are soon going to be coming into play. Charles and Warren talk about, well, what's this mean? I'm sorry, not Charles. Well, Charles and Moira, and then Warren. It's like, well, Warren takes time away from his tea, his coffee, to say, what's going on? Charles says, we've got to get back to New York. It's my fault. Absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that's what's going on with Phoenix. So we flash back to the Phoenix, and there she is. Another fantastic panel. Byrne draws her face like she's Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford complaining about no wire hangers.
Oh, God. I'm also thinking The Exorcist, a little...
The Linda Blair.
Yeah, Linda Blair.
Sweet Satan, yeah.
Pazuzu, the demon.
So, yeah, we have... Or peak Stephanie McMahon. We have her soaring towards a sun, right? She's going to charge up in the sun. What's she doing here? Why is she going towards this star? I don't know if it's the sun.
She sees a star, and she has this sort of gleam in her eye, as we said. And
hurtling toward it.
She's hurtling towards it, and you're thinking, is she going to destroy herself here? And there's a great caption in one of these panels. What matters is that Dark Phoenix lives and all creation is her domain to do with as she pleases.
Yeah. I mean, he can't state enough how powerful or how meaningless Earth stuff is to her at this point. You know, she's all about power. What kind of power?
Unlimited power!
Thank you. I needed that. She encounters this sun probe. There is a Star Core 1 probe. Dr. Corbeau, Dr. Peter Corbeau, yes, is on there.
I know his name. Peter Corbeau, yes. Super Dr. Astronaut Peter Corbeau.
Watching the sun.
That was, okay, I have to say, I lifted that right out of Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, which is not a Place to Be Nation podcast.
No, I should stress, and I've never listened, so I'm not influenced, but I understand we're going over some of the same territory, but, you know, they're smart and we're not, so it's all good.
Well, they have a great love for Super Dr. Astronaut.
Okay.
They play a very nautical theme behind his scenes anytime he comes up.
You mean they have production values?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they have production values.
That's what a Patreon is for. I got
that's,
you.
They do have a Patreon as well. And standards. But, you know, yeah, this is the Star Corps, the space station shuttle. Captained by Super Doctor Astronaut Peter Corbeau, and they're seeing this Phoenix effect, and as she's zipping across space here, and it turns out she has used the sun as kind of a cosmic slingshot.
Goes around and boom, there we go. We've seen that in other, we see it in science. You know, people talking about slingshot effects, but she collects her momentum and it shoots her past Saturn. And there it is, the slingshot effect. She boosts her speed. She's going even faster than the speed of light. By the time Super Doctor Astronaut Corbeau finishes his sentence, she's past Jupiter. And then she goes past Uranus. And she's out of the solar system. She's approaching other galaxies. She creates a stargate and goes where? Where is she going? She's into a galaxy far, far away. That can't be random. Into a galaxy far, far away.
No, probably not. You know, probably not random, but...
this is a post-Star Wars comic.
It is. Is it a post-Empire Strike Back?
Like 3 months. Okay. 1980. So maybe there is synchronicity there that collective unconscious is... People were thinking about Star Wars coming back, and... So that's on your mind.
We have seen other Star Wars references.
In X-Men, we have. So she's just hurtling towards a bigger sun, bigger star. Now she's talking as though she's Jean, though. We've got thought bubbles, thought balloons, as though she is not a goddess. Transition took more out of me than I anticipated. This is not the Gene font or the Phoenix font. This
right.
She's hungry.
Yep, because she's weakening here, and sort of, you know, her core personality seems to be kind of reasserting itself, but she's still driven by this great desire, this lust, if you will. She says, "I'm ravenous. Before I go on, I need sustenance.
Give me that son.
Yep.
Give me and back my son." She plunges herself into the heart of the sun, which is or not our sun, not soul, but no. What's the name of this sun? Do we know the star?
I do not know that we are given a name. I mean, this is what happens here. The way it's presented is sort of incidental for what is a quite monumental development.
Numerically, especially, because...
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's described as much like our own sun.
Okay, so we have
G-type
to think...
G-type star, whatever that means.
G-type. She must hit it right at the G spot. She
must.
It's a big sun. It's a big star. It's hot. It's a big star. It's great. It's a very good star. It's the best. It's very hot. The heat is very hot.
Never going to believe how hot this star is.
I mean, people are talking about this star. Normally,
unlike any other star,
this star could live billions of years. Normally, well, but that was
it before could.
The Dark Phoenix ate it. She eats a star.
Right, and we are told, unfortunately, here that orbiting the star is a system of 11 planets. The fourth is inhabited by an ancient, peace-loving civilization. On the planetary day side, they see the light first, the awful light of Armageddon, filling the sky from horizon to horizon, 10 minutes after leaving the murdered star. Many who see this light, the last thing they will ever see, are confused, frightened, a very few, who realize at once what has happened. Have time to curse the cruel fate or make their peace with their god. Then they all die. And we see depicted these asparagus or broccoli.
Yeah, broccoli humanoids. Doesn't have straight hair. They look like tikis to me or something. Scooby-Doo villains or something. But they've got hands. They're anthropomorphic. Yes. They don't have noses.
No, they don't seem to.
On
they have
MU,
eyes.
They're blue. What color are they on your actual copies?
The hair is blue, and the skin is kind of greenish.
Okay, so they have
light greenish.
Maybe the powers to be, if you're a WCW fan, decreed that asparagus people, broccoli people, are too much of a joke. We need to make them blue. Because on MU, they're blue, two different shades of blue. Dark blue for the hair, or, you know, Superman, Lois blue for the hair, and light blue for the skin. They are not asparagus.
I wonder what MU is sourced from, and maybe it's something that has been recolored. I mean, as many times as this has been collected.
Masterworks or the trade paperbacks. Yeah. Instead, they kind of look like Neil Gaiman's The Endless, in a way.
I can kind of see that. Yeah, I can kind of see that. I will say that, more importantly than all, that they have feelings, Todd. So
yes.
We see them embracing each other in abject terror. I mean, they have features not terribly like our own, but not so different that it, you know, fails to convey the just inhumanity of this situation.
But,
and we've actually seen a member of this race before. Do you remember where?
We did see them on the classic David Seville and the Chipmunks song, My Friend the Witch Doctor, He Told Me What to Say. No, where did we see them?
We covered during Marvel Age, I believe 1964, Avengers issue number 4, which was notably the modern reappearance of Captain America. There was kind of a random alien antagonist in that issue who was unmasked at the end, sort of one of those early, like, before, like, Stan and Jack were developing fleshed out villains, you'd have these sort of one-off aliens or monsters show up. And yeah, it was a dude that looked strikingly similar to the way these guys are depicted.
Has anybody gone and retconned or explicitly stated that?
Yeah, I think it is actually canon. And that was the intent. I couldn't tell you where.
An ancient peace-loving civilization, Tim.
Right.
They were capable. I know that they're, go ahead.
They're called the Dabari, for what it's worth.
Okay. If they were capable of interstellar travel, especially mm-hmm. in the very early days of the Silver Age, couldn't they have had any kind of warning system that this was about to happen?
That thought kind of occurred to me as well, reading this. But, you know, I kind of think that maybe they fell into the trap of... maybe they, like, elected a leader who really went against their own best interests and just de-emphasized things like science and appealed to their fear and their... very misplaced and unearned feelings of exceptionalism, like really scapegoated others. And, you know, more than all of that, perhaps the supreme leader of the Dabari people established like an isolationist cult of personality around himself.
Yes.
And, you know, when things like that happen, not only do you fail to see the forest for the trees, you can't get your florets out of your ass long enough to look up and see the sky exploding.
There are very good broccoli people on both sides of the planet, the planetary day side, the planetary night side. There's both good people on it. Perhaps you're right.
What have we done to these people?
I don't know. We've inflicted our own troubles, our own issues upon them. The planet is nuked. A heat flare. No, the Dabari do not deserve this. But at this point, they're not even named. Guess how much face time we see of the Dabari in their destruction of the planet. The Jean Grey is doing here. The Phoenix is doing here. We see them for one panel. We get
see one panel.
Exactly one panel to understand that this planet is getting destroyed. Billions of people. It is. Do they ever give a body count to this?
I want to say they do. Let's see. I want to say like 8 billion. Why is that number in my head? But we are talking billions. Yes.
Billions. Souls.
And, I mean, we do get quite a bit of seeing the planet itself burn.
The planet. Yes.
Yeah.
Not the people.
Not the
yes.
people so much. But, I mean, we understand this is a heavily populated planet.
Tim,
I mean,
are you a fan of roast broccoli?
It depends.
I like roasted Brussels sprouts, but they're the best way.
Oh, those are great.
But yeah. I mean, broccoli is enjoyable in different ways, no matter how you cook it. This is not boiling the broccoli. This is just frying it, I think. And
right. She needed to find a planet of Brussels sprouts, people.
Mm.
That'd be tasty.
Imagine the scent, the smell.
Oh, God.
8 billion
well,
Brussels sprouts.
Yeah. Broccoli, too, though, man. Especially
that's true. Bro. Yeah. That's true.
Mm.
So, Phoenix just killed a planet. There must be consequences. Much like if my son were to play video games for too long, there must be problems. Must be consequences. Thankfully, my son didn't kill 8 billion people on Overwatch just now, but Dark Phoenix did. In this planet of the Dabari, what's the name of the planet? Dabari World? Dabari?
We have a witness to this event. They are, it's a kind of Shi'ar scout cruiser, who we're pulling up with now, and they actually do name the planet. They say it's called Debari. Well, no, the star system is called Debari. The planet itself goes unnamed.
We'll say it's Debari 4. How about that?
Yeah, we'll just call it Debari 4. That sounds good. Yep. Okay.
What a nicely drawn starship.
Uh-huh.
It's really nice. But we get to see our friends, the 2D heads, Shiar, as opposed to Kazar. They always look like Alice in Wonderland characters to me with their funky heads. We've seen them before. We saw them earlier, you know, in the Cochrane run Burn days. But they all have this characteristic of a head that looks kind of like a Revolutionary War hat or like a Napoleon hat, but it's their head, it's their hair. What's the deal with that, Tim?
I think this is sort of an avian type species. They have rather bird-like features. I think this is supposed to be some kind of plumage or feathers of some sort, kind of a cross between the hair that we have on our heads and feathers.
Well, Lilyandra's sister is known as Death Bird, so there's that. I get that, I suppose. And we do get a nice view of kind of the side view of a Shiar lieutenant or officer here, where you see it's kind of slicked back. So imagine kind of the Wolverine thing, but extending to a point at the top. Kind of an interesting look. I guess I had never considered it. It seems like it's kind of a lazy drawing choice to me, because they all look the same. The heads always look
the
same.
Yeah, it's sort of featureless, yeah. I wonder if there's been any really good, like, Shiar cosplays. There's got to be, right?
You would think so, but Shiar is one of those things that they're not featured in movies or cartoons all that often, so only the deep fans, the deep cut fans, the people that read the comics would do the cosplay, and usually fat guys who read comics aren't really good at cosplay. I'm overgeneralizing here, but cosplayers, you know,
I'm not good at it, so I can't disagree.
And I'm terrible at it, you know. I couldn't even grow a decent Green Arrow goatee here. So, yeah, cosplayers tend to shy away from deep cuts like this, but I would love to see it. I'd love to see it. I'm not all cosplayers, of course, but, you know, SDCC, if you saw a quality Queen Lilandra cosplay, I would mark out for that, especially if she was hanging out with Professor Xavier in basketball sweatpants and a headband.
Yes.
So they observe her flying by, and we see a typo on this page. Can you find it? Look at the very top left panel and the bottom panel, and read the script, because the planet Debari can also be known as Bedari.
Oh gosh!
You see it? Look at that. Hire me, Marvel.
Bedari.
Well, maybe it can be read both ways. Maybe that's the unique characteristic of the Broccoli Planet, is that Bedari and Debari are the same place. But
well, guess what? It was 5 billion people that just got exterminated.
8 billion roasted broccoli people died in one panel, and then you see the planet. You step back.
Billion up in flames just like that on this, due to the insatiable hunger of the Phoenix.
The Shiar ship fires upon Jean Grey, the Phoenix flying through the cosmos, and she says, "Whoever you are, I don't recognize your ship, but you've made a big mistake."
Yeah.
And she separates the wing, basically. It says, "Scratch one propulsion nacelle." And I'm sure those are the words she used.
Yeah, really. This is the part in Star Trek scripts where it just says tech and they fill in the details later.
Yes. So, anyway. She actually, after she mind scans them, she does realize that they are Shiar. And she's kind of excited about that.
Mm-hmm. I will say that the animated series, which adapted the Phoenix and Dark Phoenix sagas, handled this quite deftly. Like, they aren't gonna have one of their main characters massacre 5 billion people on a Saturday morning children's television show. But she does consume a star and wipe out the entire solar system. They make a point when that version of this Shi'ar scout craft approaches the scene to stress that the system was entirely uninhabited, but it was just the luck of the draw that she happened to hit a barren system. Like, it very easily could have been populated and a lot worse. So
isn't she going into Galactusville here? You know, I've got to eat planets to stay alive.
I kind of see what you're saying, yes. I mean, the only difference is a very, kind of technical distinction in that she's not eating planets, she's eating stars, but
right.
same difference, right?
I mean, and she can scan the ship that's firing at her, but she doesn't psychically hear 8 billion broccolis dying.
Crying out and then are silenced.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. She's beyond. You know, there's actually a Claremont quote that I meant to share, and I think I can if I can pull it up right now, where he sort of comments on this development, which, I mean, is a huge, huge development. We're talking one of our main characters from this series, a longtime superhero, and Jean Grey, who is just. I mean, she's just crossed the moral event horizon here.
Parallax.
Yeah. I mean, how can you come back from that?
And
so
we're getting her thought balloons, and we're not seeing remorse, or we're not even seeing a different characterization necessarily in this, other than she's in the moment. We don't feel her necessarily being evil the way she's being written on these particular pages.
Right. Right, and that's the thing. This is what Claremont has to say on Phoenix destroying the Dabari. This is from the X-Men Companion, and this is not one of those many, many years later.
This is the Fantagraphics one?
This is the Fantagraphics
book. I have both of these. These are great.
Yeah, there's two. They're great. This one is from 1982, so just 2 years after this story was published. And it was Peter Sanderson, right? The great comics historian.
Yes.
So anyway, Claremont says, there was no awareness of right and wrong. She was beyond that. When she consumed Dabari, it was the equivalent of a human being destroying an anthill. Oh, we're sorry we have to kill you, ants, but we're hungry. We've got to eat something. We've got to plow this for a freeway. On an evolutionary scale, they were not sentient beings to her. Same goes for the starship. And again, in her defense, they shot first. Okay, he's reaching for that last part, I think. But you see, this is just, she's on a level where she's kind of beyond our human trappings of good and evil. And I don't know, I have mixed feelings about that, because so much of the story up to that point has been emphasizing, is Jean still in there? The whole push and pull between love and lust, and she's driven by these desires, and that's the whole point of this. That's why Phoenix is so out of control. Is, I don't know, I kind of look at it the way someone who's lived a life of extreme repression, when they go off to college and start wilding out big time. When those shackles come off, it's kind of similar to that, but on a cosmic scale. And that's been Jean's story, and that's something that's been emphasized throughout our reading here, is that she had these psychic circuit breakers in place, right? That she
plowed through,
been kind of put in a corner and told, you can't. This is what your level is, right? And this is where. This is your role in this world, and this is your place in it. And now she's learning, hey, wait, there's a lot more out there. And she's kind of reveling in these powers now. More on that later, I would say.
Yeah, next two issues, or well, the next few issues after this, we will talk more about that, maybe beyond that when we talk about the untold story of these days. But
yeah,
she then disables the ship, plays with it for a while, it sounds like. You know, no weapons, no power, the ship is disabled, and then she preys upon it. Then she basically engulfs it in her Phoenix Force. And Lilandra is watching at this point.
And right, she has been summoned due to this series of events. What luck, though, for a of all empires, the Shi'ar, right, to be up there. Of course, you figure if they are very, like, multi-galaxy, star-spanning empire, that this is not too far outside the realm of possibility. That they would have been, you know, just sort of cruising space and happen upon an event like this.
And, you know, we didn't see the Shi'ar in a whole lot of other places other than the X-Men at this point. But we would eventually in other comics. But, you know, we can kind of get a sense of the reach of their empire, sense of how big they are as a force, a cosmic or a galactic police force or empire. You know, they interact with other systems, other alien races. So Lilandra knows it's the Phoenix. She was afraid this was about to happen or would happen eventually. And so she's got to get on the horn to Xavier and take care of business here. So we're going to go back to Earth and wrap it up with our last page here. The Avengers, the X-Men are back here on panel at the X-Mansion. Everybody's kind of, oh, we got our butts kicked.
Yeah.
And
chilling in the kitchen.
Except for Wolverine, who's eating, who's getting beers out. Obviously. Yeah. Yep, there's beers. Well, what do we do now? Jean's gone.
I like Beast and Nightcrawler sitting side by
side. Exactly
the
same pose, which is great.
Posture and everything.
Your blue characters seating on there. Yeah, love it. We kind of wind down, like, what's going to happen now? We're kind of, everything is coming to a conclusion point of Phoenix having all this power, having eaten the broccoli people, blown up their son, killing the Shi'ar spaceship, and then finally the X-Men are kind of, well, what do we do? Yeah. Licking their wounds, and Scott feels in his psychic rapport with Jean that she's coming back. She's heading back to Earth, and she's hungry. Dun, dun, dun. I'm hungry.
How is she still hungry? My goodness. But that's the power of the Phoenix.
The Phoenix is like my son Aaron. It's never not hungry. It will keep eating and keep eating.
Relatable.
Yeah, same. He at least he comes out about it honestly. And to tell tales out of school, my wife has just brought me Sonic.
Oh!
Which is a rare treat here in Sacramento, California, because there are only maybe two Sonics within 30 miles, and they were out in that neck of the woods, and so I have Sonic here, and I know that's a favorite of yours. And coincidentally, we've reached the end of Uncanny X-Men 135.
That we have. Monumental issue here. I mean, this is low-key one of the biggest books of... Are we still in the Bronze Age? When does that cut off?
Bronze Age, to me, ends... You know, I like to
think... Two issues from now?
No. You could think of a new age starting, but I think of Crisis as the end of the Bronze Age.
Okay, that's fair.
But to me, you know, I even think of post-Crisis stuff as continuing just because it's always... I think if you live through it, you think of it always continuing. It's always now. You know, you feel now like you did back then.
Yeah.
But
well, I remember when the modern age was the 90s,
right,
and we're
what a
two, three
name.
Decades on. So,
hugely important issue, at least the way they were written at this point before retcons and things changed the way we think about it. But, yeah. It's just hard to imagine this. And Scott's even doesn't even acknowledge, you know, he doesn't know how what she's just done. Just knows right. that she's coming.
He doesn't know the specifics. Yeah.
Craving just, power. Why is she coming back to Earth? Well, we'll find out.
We will find out. And I do understand there was some kind of behind the scenes drama with, I mean, there's going to be a lot of behind the scenes drama, yes. but with this development in particular, you have, again, a major character now crossing a moral event horizon. And Claremont talks about, again, in the X-Men Companion, I'm not going to read the whole quote, but he's explaining the change in editors that had occurred somewhat recently during this run, where they had Roger Stern, when Claremont and Byrne started up back in, I guess, 108, and he has recently departed, handed the reins over to Jim Salicrup. Yeah, so you'll see Jim Salicrup credited as the editor on this issue. Apparently, Claremont is explaining that he wanted Salicrup to really get this cleared with editor-in-chief Jim Shooter, like, way before it was going to be a problem. And Shooter kind of deferred back to Salicrup and said, you know, he had confidence in the creative team. It's approved, fine, do it. And, you know, it sounds like there's basically one of those communication breakdowns that happens when you think, well, I did my due diligence, I'm good, but, you know, there's just kind of too many cooks in the kitchen. It's one of those games of telephone, da-da-da. And turns out when Shooter actually saw, again, you really have to see the panels for it to convey the enormity of what happened here. Claremont says, Shooter popped a cork. And that was exactly what we were afraid of all along.
That's on Jim Shooter, who went on to have, well, a little bit of success a few years later with the Valiant. And then basically, what's he do now? Nothing. So, I mean,
I have such mixed feelings about Jim Shooter. Secret Wars 2. I mean,
one of these things is not like the other.
No. But stay tuned to Marvel Age. I will say that it's weird. His Shooter's reaction to this issue in particular, and the scene that we described, the Dabari people being slaughtered, changes the direction that Byrne and Claremont wanted to take this. I think it's a huge change for the better.
But I think so, too. It worked out. But, again, I have a feeling that we're going to complete this Dark Phoenix saga, and then maybe we'll dedicate an issue to the, I want to say, the Apocrypha, the story around it. And then,
gotcha.
Or maybe we can do it in a two-part episode. But, yeah, I would love to hear both sides of that, but I agree with you that it worked for the better. I think it gave them more interesting stories to tell.
It's just funny because you think of, when you hear the term editorial interference, you always think, oh, well, that's such an enormous compromise. It's sacrificing creative vision, and it makes the end product so much worse, right? And I think that is the reality.
See DC Comics in 2019.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
See X-Men comics in the 1990s.
Yes.
Not all of the 1990s, but especially towards the end there. And this is one of those examples where I don't know. We'll get into it more, as you say. I don't want to blow my wad on that in this episode here.
No. But we will get into it. We have a dramatic last panel, Cyclops saying, like I said before, and she's hungry. And next is Child of Light and Darkness, which is always my favorite episode or issue title of any X-Men comic ever. I love that title. And I can't wait to read it with you, reread it again for like the 11th time, but with annotations and commentary on the next issue of Conversation Comics. And I said issue again, and this is an episode, and that's the I've done that every time we've had a show, because we're reading comic issues, we're doing podcast episodes. Nonetheless, thank you for joining us. It's been quite a journey. That was the longest 18 pages. We are back in our mid-season form of this is how Conversation Comics goes, people. You are able to get everything you wanted to know about the X-Men and then some. Much longer show than it would ever actually take to read the episode, read the issue. There I am again. But thank you for listening. It's good to be back. I think we'll be back sooner rather than later here on Place to Be Nation Pop. Tim, we've went over your shows. Any parting words or ways people can follow you if they so desire and if they have questions about the X-Men and the Byrne Claremont run?
Sure. You can. Best place to find me is on my Twitter. I am at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-6-8. Yes, that is an X-Men reference, so there you go. Right off the bat, you know you've come to the right place. So if you want to chat X-Men comics, if you want to chat this run, or WCW, or any other podcasts or interests that you have, especially sports, of course, please run me down.
Water sports.
And, these coast-to-coast connections of ours, Todd, are not always the easiest in the world to do, but I trust it will be sooner than 18 months when we get together again.
Of course.
And we are gonna get through this Dark Phoenix saga together.
The immediate goal is to finish this particular run, the Dark Phoenix saga, before X-Men Dark Phoenix comes out.
The movie, yes.
Which coming, is in June, I think.
Allegedly, yes.
If it ever comes out. Right. It will come out. Yeah. That's another story.
Thank you for doing this with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for making the time, and it was great talking with you. We will see you on the next episode of Conversation Comics.